Okay, I guess we're ready to begin. Good morning and welcome to the Unitarian Universalist House of Fellowship. We're glad to be able to get together here, have some stimulating conversations. We're glad to have new people come with new ideas, new views, new opinions, as long as they agree with ours. No, I mean, stimulating conversations, different viewpoints, enjoy the fellowship and the friendship that comes with being here. So let me follow my... our next... this is announcements. When do we do the greeting, right? Maybe now, right? If you'd like to turn to your neighbor and you don't know them, or you do and you just want to say hello... go ahead and do that. Shake hands. If you're new, whatever. I know. Okay, this is kind of the high point of a UU fellowship, is to do the actual fellowship, but we do have a program, so you can continue on your conversations at a later time. So we now have, if anyone has announcements to make, this would be a good time to do that. The announcements that we have are in the bulletin here. You can see there's some good things going on: Halloween parade, parents' night out. All kinds of good things going on in the religious education class. So if you have any announcements, now's the time to make them. And if not, I will light the chalice. This chalice is a symbol of the light that comes from being together, a little symbol of youth and vigor, something to get us going in the morning. Okay, we are fortunate to have with us a couple of great song leaders, and we're going to sing the opening hymn, number 207, Earth Was Given as a Garden. And Dick and Pat are going to be our song leaders. We sorely miss Marilyn now that we don't have someone that can play the piano every day, but these folks can do just as well, if not better. And that is number 207.
Thank you.
Okay, now is time for joys and concerns. So if you have some personal information that you would like to share with us, some changes in your life or events, we've got a microphone that'll come around if you just raise your hand, and now is the time for you to express your joys and concerns.
Once, when I was swimming, I got to meet Eric Chanteau, an Olympic gold swimmer.
You spent yesterday with him.
I spent yesterday with him.
Wow. Cool. Oh, we got a Halloween guest here coming in. It looks like a little duck right up the aisle there. Big Bird. Oh, yeah, Big Bird. Thank you.
Well, having heard that my third cousin was here, yes, I am related to Eric Chanteau, although I do not swim anywhere near, so I guess that's my concern. Actually, I do have a joy. the fellowship dinners, used to be called the circle dinners, have now met twice, and we've had very nice dinners together, nice food, great conversation. There's a sign-up sheet out in the narthex for anyone who'd be interested in joining us. November, what was the date on that?
Second, I think.
Bryce and Shirley of Holbrook will be hosting that that fellowship dinner.
Okay, thank you. Other joys and concerns? Okay, if not, do you have one, Mark?
Mark Mosier, since a good number of the folk dancers are Unitarians, I just want to say we had a great time last night. We had a little Halloween party. It was a lot of fun.
All right.
A joy.
Good. Okay, other joys and concerns? I'm going to change the list of the bulletin here a little bit. We'll do the reading right before the program. So now the reason that I'm changing that is the reason is about growing old. And, you know, I think the kids don't. What the heck? We'll be interested in that a little bit later on. So we'll do the reading after the children's conversation. So I'm going to do the children's conversation, and I'm going to talk about children in Vietnam. So if you all would like to come up around here, I've got some pictures I'd like to show you. And I'll sit down here. Yeah, I have to get up here so you can see these pictures. They're not all perfectly, they're not real big as I'd like them to be. Like I'd like, well, it worked before, didn't it? So, yeah, we'll look at this globe first, huh? Where are we? Where are we? In Kansas, and what country is that?
That's in USA.
USA. What's that USA stand for?
United States.
Go ahead.
United States of America.
Okay, so we're going to talk about different countries, and once a year I go to Vietnam. Where is Vietnam?
It's Asia.
All right.
Right,
you're exactly right. Yeah, there you got it. Okay, now there is Vietnam, and then over here is Kansas, right? All the way around there. Actually, I go this way. You go this way. Yeah, that's right. It's quicker to go that way. You go over the ocean, and you change times when you go over there, and it's really interesting. And it takes you about 24 hours. You can go out here to Manhattan Airport, get on the plane, and about then go to Chicago, and then go to Hong Kong, and then go to Saigon or Ho Chi Minh City. It takes about a total of 24 hours. Long time, huh, on airplanes and in airports. And it costs about $1,245 for this ticket that I bought for next month. So it's not easy, it's not cheap, but it's very interesting. And the reason that I like to go there is because some friends of mine We have built a library learning center in Vietnam, this town called Bong Son. And so they don't have many libraries in Vietnam. They don't have the idea of free libraries where you can go into. So we decided to build one there. And here's a picture of the library. You can see on top of it, there's a kind of a plaque here, and it says, in another language, it says the Library of Bong Son, Vietnam. Let's see. Would you hold that when I'm done with that, or you can pass it around if you want to? Okay, here's another picture. What's different about this picture? It's got people in it, right? What kind of people? Yeah, it looks like it. Here's another one. Yeah, like here's a little better picture. What do you see there? Kids.
School children.
Yeah, school children. And what are they doing? They're just kind of standing there. What are they wearing?
They're wearing their school uniform.
Exactly. They all have a little red kerchief, a white blouse, and a blue pants or a dress, right? And here's another picture of them. Are they sad or mad or what? They look like they're kind of happy, don't they? They're happy to go to school, to have a library learning center. They look like they're all pretty happy. And here's another one. Here is a picture inside. See what they're, oh yeah, there's the school district teacher. She's in charge of the school district, and here's the librarian. And here's the little girl here, this little girl here. When Pat and I went there last year to dedicate this Library Learning Center, this little girl sang songs, two or three songs, and one of the songs she sang to us was Jingle Bells. And she sang it in Vietnamese and English. Now you think about her singing Jingle Bells and driving through the snow in a one-horse open sleigh. She did that too. Well, they don't have snow there, so it was a really interesting song for her to sing, right? But she did a great job, and they're all reading and doing, having fun there. And here's the next one. Here's some more kids. See them doing their stuff there. They have these nice tables and chairs they're sitting at. They all look like they're pretty happy. And here's a, there you go. Here's a girl reading a book. What does it say on that book?
Super Songs for Children.
Super Songs for Children. Yeah, yes.
One.
So, oh, yeah, book one, right. Super Songs for Children. Book one, yeah. That does look like the girl that sang the song. Looks like she's looking for some new songs, right? She's going to look for new songs, and isn't it interesting? She's reading that book in English, right? But here's another guy. He's reading a book, and what does that say? Yeah, okay. This one says guitar, right? That's the new one, right? That the words on the top are Vietnamese, and they mean how to play guitar. So she's learning how to play the guitar, but it's written in Vietnamese, but the word for guitar is the same in Vietnamese and English, which is very handy. Okay, here's some more. So now you know a Vietnamese word, right? Guitar. And here are some kids at the table, more kids reading, and they have pretty tables, and those tables are made from the forests around where they live. Mm-hmm.
I see the girl that's reading Super Songs.
Yeah, that's her. Yeah. Okay, and then here's one more. You want that? Go ahead. Take a look a little closer. It's real interesting to see kids, young people from other countries. Now, what's this guy reading?
B.B. Bang Bong.
B.B. Bang Bong. Is that English?
No,
it's not English, is it? It's Vietnamese, right? What do you suppose BB means in English? Here's the way they say it. You see those little marks over there? It means instead of saying BB, it's Bay Bay. And what do you think Bay Bay means in Vietnamese? Baby. There you got another word, right? Another word, you know. Two words in Vietnamese. And since you're so good at that, I'm going to teach you a couple more words. Whenever I go to another country, I always like to learn, hello, how are you, I'm fine, thank you, and goodbye. That's enough, right? So here's, and people really appreciate it when you speak their language. They really like that when you say something in their language. So here's the first one. What's this say in English? And that's right, ciao. If you are in Vietnam and you see some person and you want to say hello, you just say ciao. Very easy, huh? Ciao. Okay, and here's the next one. What's this say in English? How are you? Now here, this is a little more difficult, right? Te nao la ban. Te nao la ban. Can you say that? That's perfect. Te nao la ban. Te nao la ban. Usually, for me to learn a new phrase in a new language, I need to say it at least 7 times. So you can practice that sometime. Te nao la ban means how are you? And here, give you that. Or no, I'll put this up here. I'm fine. This says I'm fine. And what's this say? Toilatat. 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 Yeah. Now, sounds kind of funny, doesn't it? Toilatat. Now, what's the deal with these letters? They got a little thing on the top of them and another mark over here. And what's the deal? That's different than English, right? So they're using Roman alphabet, English letters, but they put little marks on them. And those little marks, called diacritical marks, tell them how to say that vowel. So each of these has a certain sound. Unlike in English, you know, where the O sound sometimes is different. And in words like toy, that's the O sound, toy. And if you have a word like tot, that's like a small child, T-O-T, that O sounds different, tot. And then that tot, T-O-T, is the same sound as the word she taught me how to speak Vietnamese, T-A-U-G-H-T. So English is kind of confusing in that way, and you have to learn those spellings and how to pronounce it. In Vietnamese, they just put little marks above all the vowels, and then you know the vowel sound, so that's real handy. Toilatat. Can you say that again? Toilatat?
Toilatat.
Yeah, you're good. Okay, and here's a real good one. Thank you. And this is?
Come on.
Come on. That's a good one, huh? Come on. Come on. Thank you. Come on. Okay, and here's the last one. Goodbye. And what do you think that is? Tambiet. 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 So tambiet is goodbye. So now you know English, and now you know Vietnamese, and you know the three most important, I think, are ciao. Ciao. And then thank you. Come on. Come on. And then the last one is tambiet. Tambiet. Okay, so do you have any questions about those kids or that school, or would you like to ask them any questions? If you would, I'm going to go over there next month, at the end of next month, and if you want to write up some questions that you'd like me to take over there, I'll ask those kids whatever questions you have. You know, you might want to ask them, what's their favorite game, or what's their favorite song, or anything that you might want to do, if you want to do that. And when I go over there, and if they want to ask you some questions, I should get a picture of you, and I can take it along, and I can show them this picture, and they can see if they have anything for you, any questions. Well, Ed, do you have any other questions about this, going to Vietnam? You want to go? It'd be kind of fun, wouldn't it? Really fun to go to other countries and see people and their different customs and eat their food. Okay, so if you have no other questions, that'll be it for today. So, tam biet. Tam biet. Tam biet. Thank you. Okay, now is time for our offertory to keep the lights running and everything going and the heaters going and everything. We've got a great place to be here and to meet together. And so we will play the offertory music, which you see is Flying Home by the Benny Goodman Sextet. This ought to be great. It's one of Dick Beeman's favorites, and I'm looking forward to hearing it. Good job. Okay, next here we have the reading. Yeah, reading. So every day I read this 365 Tao. Every morning when I'm doing my important things, I read the one verse out of here. Each day has a verse, and they are stimulating, and they set the tone for you for the day. If you're worried about stuff, wake up early, you got a lot of problems and stuff, it sort of gives you, centers you and gives you a kind of an idea of, it helps you deal with things. And so I found one from a couple days ago that I'm going to read to you because I thought it was appropriate for this time of the year, the fall, and for us. This is, a moving door hinge never corrodes. Flowing water never grows stagnant. Even in the autumn of your life, you cannot give up growth. If you do, you only invite decline. All the different aspects of a person, body, mind, and spirit, have one curious quality. If they cease to be exercised, they stop growing. Once they stop growing, they begin to atrophy. That is why no matter how much you have accomplished, and no matter how old you are, you must keep exercising all parts of yourself. We cannot reverse aging completely, but we can slow it down. As long as we are vital, we will not suffer as much. Although aging is natural, sometimes following Tao means more than following the route of least resistance. Why slide into old age, illness, and senility? The way of challenging oneself is also a valid but difficult path. Sometimes Tao chooses the difficult over the easy. So there are a lot of challenges in life, and one of them that I think is really important is the challenge of explaining Unitarian Universalism to other people. And they have a certain belief, and they... You know, we've shortened that Unitarian Universalism sounds like a some kind of a cult, really. You know, it's got this long, funny name, and it's not a Methodist or a Baptist. And Unitarian Universalism, I know something strange is when I hear that it's coming up here. Who are these people? And then we shortened it to you. You know, and the first time I heard that, I thought, what is this, a bird call at somebody? Is it? You know, and I... You know, and so you get through those things. You know, I'm a Unitarian Universalist. We call ourselves UUs. Well, what else do you do? Well, you'd be surprised. And then we have our tenets, and it's so rational and sensible that you just want to be with people like that. And when I tell friends about it, they are so intrigued. That is, if they don't have a rock solid belief in a certain way that they have committed themselves to, they are so intrigued. They say, that sounds really interesting. Usually they don't come because they don't want to give up their Sunday mornings and all that, but it always is very interesting. I think it's a big challenge for us to be able to explain ourselves and to get people to come and be a part and join with us, and we need a few more people to do that because, for me, this is a stimulating environment, and that's why I love to come, and I like to see new people. So that is a real challenge to explain what we do here. And I think our speaker this morning is going to explain and talk about how he worked with the UU beliefs, Unitarian Universalism, in the military. And he's still on active duty, and we're glad to have our member, Stephen Simmons, as our speaker.
Good morning. This morning, I want to talk through a problem I have. See, I'm a soldier in the most powerful army in the world, and I have recently taken to this thing called Unitarian Universalism. This is a very complex problem because, as I understand Unitarian Universalism and the seven principles, nonviolence is key and essential. And, well, the point of an army is to master violence as a tool for whatever purpose our trusted leaders deem necessary. I will admit that there is a certain amount of it does what it's told or just follow orders that military leaders expect from subordinates, which is not a bad thing. But imagine playing a game of chess and having to explain to every piece exactly why you made a particular move. It would become awful burdensome. Now imagine you are a pawn in a game of chess, that really needs a job in an economic recession, or a bishop for that matter. How about a knight that has a family, a home, and a career, and children, prospects? Wouldn't you expect to know exactly why you moved up two and left one versus up two and right one, or why you moved at all? Chess is a poor comparison because in reality, each piece doesn't really consist of thousands of unique individuals, each with families and lives of their own. But I hope my point is across. I cannot begin to imagine the burden upon the national leadership and senior officers that make decisions that could very well cost life. Even at the lower levels, the responsibility and dedication the leader has to those that are in their care is enormous. I experienced this in my tour of duty, where I was responsible for a contingent of approximately 25 soldiers living on an Iraqi regimental compound. It was not very large and was on the outskirts of a decent-sized town. Our area was very small, was inside their base, and had reliable security, but there was always that what-if feeling we dealt with. The operations center, where I made decisions and coordinations about the partnership and missions, was outside our area in a U.S.-built wooden building under Iraqi control. We sort of ran their operations, what little operations they did or those they would let us know about, that is. I had two soldiers there at all times responsible for our equipment and keeping the Iraqis straight. I'll admit it was one of the best times of my life. I learned so much about their culture and about myself. There were many tense situations, caused mostly by misunderstandings with translators, but there were a genuine few that were conflicts of interest. I had to say no a lot, since this was at the tail end of our combat operations and the equipment and funding surpluses they had gotten in the past had all dried up. There were many fights over the remote control. You see, they had this television. We gave them the TV before I got there, but they paid for the satellite service. But it was in our area, in their building. They would come in and turn the volume way up and get sidetracked and walk away. After hiding the remote failed, I turned the batteries backwards. That secured almost a week of peace. They loved cartoons, especially Tom and Jerry, which my younger soldiers sadly never heard of. But I remember clearly. They knew most of our famous pop songs, but not what the words meant. It was interesting to converse about entertainment and politics, which was still very new to them. During Saddam's reign, the Ministry of Information dominated the market, so they were denied the unabridged information we take for granted today. One of the most confusing times is on New Year's Eve in 2009. The nearby base hosted a controlled detonation that we somehow were not tracking. We were all watching a pirated movie, Arabic subtitles on, of course, and the building shook. Everyone immediately got up, movie off, lights on, soldiers on the radio to figure it out. The Iraqi officers were walking in the area in their pajamas demanding answers. It was about 12:30 when I finally got an answer, and nobody would answer our initial radio calls. Apparently, they forgot to tell us about the stockpile of seized explosives that they had been saving for New Year's. I had to explain to a sleepy Iraqi major that this was the American version of celebratory fire. He laughed and went back to bed, and the movie resumed. I had a couple of interpreters that I couldn't trust, and that was because I could read the body language of how the other Iraqi soldiers and interpreters acted around them. One of the best was 87 years old at the time. He was a colonel in the Iraqi police before Saddam took charge, and since he was Shiite, he was purged from service. He told me he remembers riding in his father's car when he was young, all the way from Iraq to Paris. I wonder if that is even possible today. He spoke wonderful English, and we would talk a lot about world politics. The interpreters would pick English names to help us address them easier, and he picked Haji, which means respected one or elder, and literally one who has made the pilgrimage to Mecca. The sad part was the term was hijacked by us to refer to all of them in a derogatory way. That happened to be why he picked it. He had a subtle way of trying to make things better, a way to make you think. He made all those who knew him think twice about using that word in an offensive way. I know I made a difference in the perception of Americans, at least to the Iraqis I dealt with. I spent far more time with those in other uniforms than I did with my own. I consider them all great friends, and to this day keep up with a few of them on email and social media. I wouldn't trade those friendships for anything. I have to tell you about my interpreter, Tony. He was my age, and we became very good friends. It was very beneficial because Iraqi senior officers liked him too. He would tell me things because he trusted me not to reveal how I knew them, and he knew that I would just only ask the right questions and not dime them out. In exchange, I never charged him for a single day of leave. There is one conversation that sticks in my mind. He was explaining to me the peacefulness of Islam, and I knew it was coming. He asked me to convert, and he did it in such a way that offered me an easy method to respectfully decline, which was is seen as being offensive if you declined the invitation. I attempted to explain to him how I wish not to choose a religion and that I would rather learn the good things about all of them, which was me pandering at that time in my life. We got off on another subject and about the Quran, and I asked him about the potential for life on other planets and just a thought exercise. And I don't remember what he said, but that isn't the point. Another interpreter came over and because he heard a part of the conversation and joined in, creating a mix between Arabic and English, and because I was still a part of it. When a couple of Iraqi soldiers joined in, the English surely disappeared. I stopped them and asked what the problem was because the debate was getting heated. Well, in the Quran, it says, Allah spread life on earth and in the heavens, and the contention was the definition of heaven, whether it was the stars you see at night or the afterlife. The point I tried to make was that if you're here and you die and you go there, why does Allah have to put life there? You go there. Well, that didn't make things better because the Iraqi soldiers didn't understand me, and the interpreters were more interested in making their own points. An Iraqi officer joined, and I pulled Tony aside and told him that I didn't mean to get everybody arguing, but look at them. They are so almost ready to come to blows over something so petty. And Tony understood what I was saying. His eyes lit up. The argument stopped, and they all looked at Tony. They thought I had said something offensive to him about them, giving him the expression that he had of understanding. Well, I knew that is what they were asking because of their body language, and before Tony could translate me their question, I told him to tell him what I said. And with a dismissive wave of my hand, they were not happy once they realized that one American was capable of starting a fight between a group of supposedly united people. The group left, and I noticed Haji sitting next to one of my radio men helping him learn Arabic, and he was laughing. There is the Muslim holiday of Arabian, which is one of the, I know I pronounced it wrong, but it's one of the largest pilgrimage gathering on earth, in which over 10 million people go to the city of Karbala in Iraq. It is a Shia Muslim religious observance, and it's observed all over the world. And it commemorates the martyrdom of Hussein bin Ali, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, which fell in February of 2010. Saddam had really cracked down on them celebrating other sects of Islam's holidays. It was all his version, all Sunni, and even not even all the Sunnis. All the Sunnis weren't even happy with him. So this is the holiday where they beat themselves in the streets. I know we've all seen the news reports where they walk and they smack themselves, but. But on the Iraqi compound, all they had was a large picnic, and we were invited to come join. I extended the invitation to the soldiers in our area, but they were not interested, but I was. The picnic area was 70 or so yards from our area within their compound. So I walked out there with two of my interpreters, because they were hungry too, and only carried a handheld radio. They were confused at first, as they had never seen an American without a weapon. I conversed with many of them and had to put the radio in my pocket in order to shake all the hands reaching out for greetings. I was completely comfortable with just a radio. See, the radio is far more dangerous than a rifle, and besides, if the lieutenant is shooting and not on the radio, something is wrong. There was another time when I was hanging out with a couple of Iraqi officers, and they had an appointment with some mechanics from the town nearby. A while before, the U.S. military gave the Iraqi army a bunch of vehicles, specifically Ford F-350 diesels. Well, these vehicles needed replacement parts, especially sensors on the intake and exhaust due to all the sand and dust. We passed them the equipment but failed to train their mechanics on how to work on it, which we couldn't do since we contract out work on those kind of vehicles. Well, they were trying to do the same thing, and I happened to be there when the contractor showed up. The utter worried astonishment in his eyes when he seen me was breathtaking. I realized that, being a local citizen, he probably never seen an American in person without full body armor and a locked and loaded weapon probably pointing at him. When we first went into Iraq, we had a fight, and we had to do some tough things. But maybe this gentleman was in the wrong place at the wrong time back then. I stood up and shook his hand like he was anybody else, and I excused myself so they could conduct business. I didn't notice the man's surprise diminish before I left, and to this day I still wonder what he experienced to cause that expression on his face. I overseen the closure of that small area, and I became their partner from my unit's base station about 30 miles away. We were still heavily involved in the partnership, and I supervised all the joint efforts between my unit and the Iraqis. Tony and I accompanied them down to an Iraqi training base where they were scheduled to complete their mandatory training. The difference was that they couldn't bring everybody to train like our military does, since they had to maintain a presence in their compound. The Iraqi commander actually asked me if I would accompany him to his residence, which was not too far from the training base, and Tony's eyes lit up with excitement because he was from the same town. I respectfully declined, since it would have almost definitely led to me getting in huge trouble. But it was delicate, since he seemed sincere about the invitation, and he'd actually went out of his way to make sure that we were alone and that nobody who could tell on me was there. But Tony was disappointed because he goes so long without getting to see his girlfriend. While at that training base, I went on their training missions with them, and sometimes with an interpreter and sometimes without. I knew by looking at the map when we first got there that we were awfully close to the Iranian border, and I was very surprised when on one mission we came near the edge of the base that we were on, and there was no fence. There wasn't even a ditch. There was nothing. There wasn't a gate on the roads, and there was nothing between where we slept and the people we were there to find. It was a surreal feeling, and I realized that these training missions can turn real at any moment, and I was the only person who spoke English and the only person with any ammunition. It wasn't a panicked feeling, but more of a feeling of acceptance. There's one more significant story that I want to share, and it has to do with a donation drop I set up between my battalion and the Iraqi regiment. We were to donate school supplies and miscellaneous other items to a couple of schools right in town. I planned the operation, and the same group that had rotated in and out of my former small base executed it. We linked up with the Iraqis and entered the city. Everything was going well, and I missed one very important detail: overhead wires. And not power wires, but internet wires. They would have the different color Cat 5 cable, just one apartment to the other, just across the street, and phone lines, and it was it made the journey a little slower, but it didn't stop us. Other than the mine roller vehicle getting stuck in a hole while the donations were being made, everything went as planned. The vehicle was pulled out just as the donations concluded, and I'm going to show you a video of the donation.
school children of Alawat Village in southern Tikrit received a very special visit today from Iraqi and American soldiers. They came bearing gifts and school supplies for both of the boys and girls' schools in the village.
It's great doing things like this for the kids because the kids don't have anything to do with what's going on here, but they are the future of what's going to go on here. So we might as well make them a little bit more capable of dealing with the future by giving them the things that they need for school, pencils, paper, even a soccer ball to go play after school with. So.
The Iraqi army gave away sewing materials to the schoolgirls and soccer balls to the boys, in addition to the school supplies, in an effort to build a closer relationship and bridge of trust between them and the children of the village.
I feel so happy I'm giving these gifts and donations because I can tell when they smile. They are happy inside. Besides, it is a way to compensate them for the hardship and for what they have seen these past few years.
Second Lieutenant Simmons, the Engineering Military Transition Team, OIC, for the 4th Iraqi Division Field Engineering Regiment, is pleased to see the direction in which the relationship between the Iraqi military and local population is heading. He sees proof of this in the smiling and excited faces of the children today.
It was very exciting. They were really excited to see us. They were really grateful. And it was nice to see a lot of smiling faces. What my mission entails is the handover responsibility. As my mission evolves, my input gets smaller and smaller as the Iraqis begin planning and executing missions themselves. And I become more of just an observer to make sure that they thought of all different outcomes, all different scenarios. And to see something like this happen, it's a great step in the right direction.
Reporting from Alawat Village in southern Tikrit, I am Army Sergeant Reynaldo Lopez.
This is the actual border of where we lived on their compound. This is the Iraqis' wall over here. It's some of their buildings. And actually, this is, I believe it was their bathroom because a pipe comes out there and they just got the hole in the ground. But these are our walls. This was our security. And these are the little trailers that we had lived in. That's just one of their average guard. That was actually the better guard tower. I took this photo to show the people that I worked for that, oh, yeah, things aren't that bad here. So I found the best guard tower I could and said, yeah, this is what we have because I knew what I was doing there was important. It's not coming in very good, but that's Tony. We would he looked like Jeff Dunham's little puppet. He just, and when he would get angry, because he would all the time, he was very personable, and he would just outright come out and tell me how he was feeling. And he just had that, he would get those pits under his eyes, that really evil look that they show you on the news, and that's what every one of them looked like, and it was, he's just another person. Here's just a picture of us on getting ready to go on a mission, and his name was, I don't know his real name, but we called him Cougar. They would just pick the most aggressive names they could think of. Here's an aerial view. The reason I was up in that tower is because we had a directional antenna sent out to us and said, hey, if you can point it at this direction, you can get the Super Bowl. So I found the nearest tower and decided I was going to climb it with this directional antenna, but no luck. But I took a few good pictures up there. You can see this is our compound right here. That's it. That was all we lived in. This is the wooden building where I conducted all operations. The Iraqi colonel, that was his own little office there. And I was in this building here when that gentleman walked in to help fix our trucks. And the other Iraqi soldiers lived back here. The unit that was there before me, they'd actually built a lot of these buildings back here, but as you can see, it's just nothing out there. And this is looking south from the city. I didn't have a good picture of the other side, but that's where the actual city was. And this is a picture from out during that picnic I was at. Nobody's beating themselves, no blood. That's just where the news cameras run to show you what happens. And I can think of a few holidays here in America that you could find some crazy people doing some crazy things and make people believe some crazy stuff about you. So it's just, once you figure out these things, it was really, really real. That's not light enough, but this was one of the radio guys, and he looked just like the character, just 3 feet taller, in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. He looked just like him, and it was so funny. That's Tony and Haji. Haji was probably the one I learned the most from. You know, out of everybody that I dealt with in Iraq, I learned the most from him. And that's not a lot of people can say that they learned the most, that their best experiences from being over there were from a local, not their leader or the person guiding them and molding them. So, and this is from the actual donation drop. He had a little toy gun in his hand, and there's tape all over it, and you know, and 5-6 years ago, what would that have got him? You know, it's just things like that. And that was probably his grandmother, but I could notice when they were giving stuff out, because after the school was done, we had some extra stuff, and they were just giving stuff out to people on the street. She was not able to force her way to the front and grab stuff, because the Iraqi army was just kind of chucking it, and I had gotten a soccer ball and passed it, and she was pretty happy about that. So that's just some bonding, you know. You know, you're training together. We tried to put on the one team, one fight. You know, it doesn't really matter what uniform we're in. We're all there for the same reason, try to make this country a better place. And that's that for that part. My experience was chock full of small stories like the few I told you. I feel like I was extremely lucky in many situations. These days, when I think back about the greater reason why we went there to begin with, I start to question. I know why I was there. We were there to nation build and to make Iraq a more stable place. But why did we go there to begin with? I didn't join the military originally until 2006, a whole 5 years after that September day. The truth is, I didn't do a lot of thinking about it back then. I started a little while after we bugged out of the Iraqi compound, when I had a lot of spare time. I augmented that time with a couple of books I'd been meaning to start. Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion was one. And not one, but two rebuttal books, The Dawkins Delusion and God Is No Delusion. It was funny. Those three books sent me on a sort of a quest. You know, I began to understand that the more I read, the more I need to read. And to this day, I have far more books on my reading list than I can ever reasonably expect to get to. But back to the point, I began to question not only religious prejudices, but societal and political ones also. Why are we nation building? Why are we taking money from poor people in a rich country and giving it to rich people in a poor country? You know, we call it stability, but doesn't it just perpetuate a potentially unfavorable status quo? Not a status quo for us, but for those people being ruled by the governments we finance. I could not understand the morality or logic behind any of this, so I began to dig. The framers of our nation knew full and well the dangers of standing armies. They just went through it. It led to certain provisions in our founding document. You know, Congress has to reapprove money every 2 years for conflicts or for any spending. They got Posse Comitatus that came after the Civil War, said federal soldiers have no jurisdiction in the states. In the Constitution, it uses the term militia almost interchangeably with army. West Point was established to provide a strong officer corps whose ranks could be filled very quickly with volunteers at a moment's notice, which would denote the public's true opinion about whether a fight was worth having. Notably, Captain Alden Partridge, superintendent of West Point from 1806 to 1817, felt that the United States government should train young leaders to serve the public during a time of peace while filling the officer ranks of the militia in time of war. However, by 1817, his staff, who vastly disagreed with his views on the dangers of standing armies, petitioned to change the school's vacation time to the summer months. Captain Partridge responded, "The fact that no cadet has died here since its establishment, I should suppose, is sufficient proof of this position. Fuel in the winter would increase expense. In our northern institutions of learning, the longest vacations are in the winter. It would be better for the institution if there was no vacations at all than that should be so arranged as not to answer the purpose for which it was intended." This disagreement led to his court-martial, and he left West Point and founded Norwich University, which is a much-respected military academy in Vermont. His views seem almost treasonous today, especially by those who have so much to profit from the military-industrial complex. Not too long ago, I discovered the Tao Te Ching, thanks to one of these services, and I carry it in my uniform right next to my constitution, because as a citizen, I expect people in uniform not just to follow orders, but to think. There is a verse that I want to share with you, a couple of verses. Verse 31 from Stephen Mitchell's Pocket Version states, "Weapons are tools of violence. All decent men detest them. Weapons are tools of fear. A decent man will avoid them, except in the direst necessity, and if compelled, will use them with the utmost restraint. Peace is the highest value. If the peace has been shattered, how can he be content? His enemies are not demons. They are human beings like himself. He does not wish them personal harm, nor does he rejoice in victory. How could he rejoice in victory and delight in the slaughter of men? He enters battle gravely and with sorrow and with great compassion, as if he were attending a funeral." What happened to me in Iraq was not the typical experience. I'm unable to speak for other soldiers' experiences, but I will speak for my own. The enemy I went there to fight didn't exist. I left with friends. I humanized those people. They have mothers, fathers, siblings, relationships, lives, prospects, and futures. Their culture is different than ours, but we had about as much right to go there and do what we did as I do to go in your house and break a window and raid your refrigerator. Wouldn't you resist? Is it true that they are better off now as a people? Maybe. But at what human cost? The only people who can make that decision and learn the lesson is them. Nobody could have made us free. We had to make it for ourselves. And the greatest difference between our revolution and theirs is that the French left after they helped us out. It took us over a decade, and even now there is talk about going back to promote stability in the region. I almost forgot the lady who approached me in the streets outside the second school that we visited during the donation drop. She began ranting and sobbing, and from under her clothing, she pulled out a baby that was disfigured. A bystander came up and made her walk away, and he apologized to me in the best English I had heard all day. And he explained to me that she does that to any visitor, and she is crazy. And I asked him how he learned English, and he actually lived in America under a sponsorship program, but couldn't find the right kind of work to make him happy, so he decided to come back to Iraq and rebuild. I could tell he would have loved to talk, but I was in a hurry, and it wasn't until that evening that I evaluated the situation from earlier. Since our initial invasion, the percentage of babies born with problems has skyrocketed. Some blame the depleted uranium rounds that we used during the initial invasion. We used them indiscriminately. People have no idea that those rounds could be lodged in the walls of their houses or made its way into watering wells, and this is a potential third-order effect that was carried out in the name of all Americans, all of us. We are all responsible for everything the military or our government does. After all, it derives its legitimacy from our consent, making us responsible. Short-sightedness is a plague affecting all governments, but if we don't treat the cause and stop band-aiding the symptoms, the future will not be too bright. There is another verse from the Tao I want to share, verse 20. Stop thinking and end your problems. What difference between yes and no? What difference between success and failure? Must you value what others value? Avoid what others avoid. How ridiculous. Other people are excited as though they were at a parade. I alone don't care. I alone am expressionless, like an infant before it can smile. Other people have what they need. I alone possess nothing. I alone drift about, like someone without a home. I am like an idiot. My mind is so empty. Other people are bright. I alone am dark. Other people are sharper. I alone am dull. Other people have a purpose. I alone don't know. I drift like a wave on the ocean. I blow as aimlessly as the wind. I am different from ordinary people. I drink from the great mother's breast. This verse never ceases to amaze me. It is one of the many whose pages is folded over, making it a must-read every time I pull it out, and it continues to help me deal with all kinds of situations. In the further reading on this verse in particular, it explains, enlightenment is simply living free from unreality and delusion. I see delusion as a contradiction, and my morality sees service in an organization meant to be forceful as a contradiction to my morality. However, I may have never had the experiences that led to this thinking, if not for that contradiction in the first place. I will not continue down the path of contradiction. However, I understand I volunteered, and it is my duty to the Constitution and to the people to act with force on their behalf. But once my obligation is over, I will walk away. The initiation of force should be avoided at all costs. I honestly believe that most volatile situations can be solved without violence and through conversation. Typically, people who sit at a table can figure out if they are honest. Being self-interested is not evil, but being selfish is, and we live in an awful selfish world. There are a couple more verses I want to share before I finish. In 46, when a country is in harmony with the Tao, the factories make trucks and tractors. When a country goes counter to the Tao, warheads are stockpiled outside the cities. There is no greater illusion than fear, no greater wrong than preparing to defend yourself, no greater misfortune than having an enemy. Whoever can see through fear will always be safe. I will not be afraid of life. I am not alone, and if I were, I will not be afraid. What is the terror alert level today? Is it orange or yellow? Have you seen anything suspicious today that you feel like you should report? Recently, my wife and I went to Michigan to her family reunion, and while in Detroit, we stopped by the Dearborn Fresh Food Market. I wanted some chai tea. Not chai tea, but shy tea. My wife and three of her brothers and I walked through the store. It was an old Dillon's looking for the tea. It was like being back in Iraq. The first person I asked didn't speak English, and he went and got somebody who did. I asked him for chai tea, and he took me right where I just was, and I subtly hinted that I'm talking about the stuff I drank while I was in Iraq, being careful not to be too loud. He understood what I wanted. He said, the good stuff. We went over to an aisle with only foreign food, and he began asking how it was served. And I told him that I wasn't really sure, and he took me to the back and had me smell different spices. He was so helpful. I declined to purchase any spices, but picked out two boxes of chai tea. And while at the register, he came up with a sample of his favorite spice and made me promise to try it. To this day, I am ashamed that the first thought I had was suspicion, that his excitement about me wanting to share a piece of his culture with my family wasn't genuine. But after a lot of self-reflection, I was ready to drink that chai tea once we got to where we were going, and I used his spices in a generous way in spite of all the resentment and dehumanization I was conditioned to believe. I will not be ruled by fear. 57. If you want to be a great leader, you must learn to follow the Tao. Stop trying to control. Let go of fixed plans and concepts, and the world will govern itself. The more prohibitions you have, the less virtuous people will be. The more weapons you have, the less secure people will be. The more subsidies you have, the less self-reliant people will be. Therefore, the master says, I let go of the law, and people become honest. I let go of economics and people become prosperous. I let go of religion and people become serene. I let go of desires of the common good and the people become common as grass. There are people in this room that could argue this verse all day, and there are people in the government party irrelevant, that know exactly how to make your life better and are willing to use force to do it. Whether you agree with their plan or not isn't nearly as important as the end result of not having a choice in the matter, in any matter that is deemed that way. This last verse gives me hope, however. It gives me hope that others throughout centuries have read it, understand it, and have came to it on their own accord. Concepts and constructs dwarf to the need for people to guide their own way. I don't pretend to have all the answers, but I'm comfortable with saying I don't know. When it comes back to my current contradiction, it comes to this. We live in a world of contradictions. Heck, the man who publicly stated that the killing of foreign scientists would be his policy abroad got the pro-life establishment endorsement. If that's not a contradiction, I don't know what is. The fact is that the world of today, I don't have to charge the gates of the nearest government building and throw my medals at somebody just trying to feed their family to fix my contradiction. I understand the greater situation and we live in, and going against the flow of any river causes pain. I will ride the current, guiding myself to a better position for whatever lays around the bend. Thank you for letting me work through my own contradiction. It's one I still live with every day, and I hope to only use what I gained from it to help me not live in contradiction in the future. You know, I didn't think a lot when I first joined, and if I could go back and talk to myself, I wouldn't talk myself out of it. You know, there's certain little decisions that I think I'd like to change, but nothing that would change where I am now. You know, I wouldn't go back in time to change anything that could potentially affect me sitting in this room with Esther sitting right there talking to you people with this story right here. So I hope I didn't ruffle too many feathers today. And I think we have a few minutes for discussion.
Excellent talk. Is this on? Yeah. Excellent talk. Have you had a chance to follow up with any of the friends you made there?
Facebook.
I'm just curious what happened to them after you left.
Facebook has been the missing link for society, really. The internet, the unabridged communication, you know, you plug your wire in, you can get anything, talk to anybody, anywhere, I've kept up with some of the interpreters. I've wrote recommendation letters to get three of them hired back on other bases because, you know, they still need work. And I'm actually working a packet for one who wants to come to America. I wrote the recommendation letter for that, and I told him that if he needs a sponsor, somebody to keep an eye on him, a point of contact, somebody who could potentially get him a job on a local military basis and teaching English or whatever he might need. By all means, but the deal they have worked out is that he can't bring his family at first. He has to establish himself, and I think he's dragging his feet because family is very important to everybody. The Iraqi soldiers I worked with, I haven't kept up with. They didn't have the same access as the interpreters. The interpreters all had their little smartphones and, you know, basically just like kids today, but the soldiers lived in a little more austere conditions, and I never got around to social media connecting with them.
Pass that down. Okay. Thank you so much for talking today, and I had a bartender friend here in town who'd tell me stories about in Iraq going into homes, kind of like you mentioned, and holding a family for a few days until they check things out. And I, of course, reacted differently in my head, different ways. But one of the ways I knew that he had a lot of heart, and I was glad that he was there for those families. And I would say the same to you, that I'm glad you were there. Even though it feels like a strange thing for me to say, I'm very glad you were there, and thank you for sharing that with us.
Thank you.
Can you talk a little bit about any hope you have for the future in not only Iraq, but the whole surrounding states and our way forward?
Well, history's a big circle, and I work with, Where I work with a lot of people who don't wear the uniform, even now at Fort Riley. And there's a very senior guy who retired, and he's working there now, and he keeps telling me, we don't want to go like we're going back in a circle, and we don't reinvent the wheel. And I keep telling him, I don't want to go in a circle. I want to go in a straight line. I want to go the right direction. I don't want the people 5 years from now to have to sit there and figure out things that I've already figured out. But we have an urge to repeat history. And we have the inability to learn from other people and other people's mistakes. I don't sit here and pretend like I've never made a mistake that twice, more than once, one that somebody's told me they've made, and hey, you're going down that wrong road, you're going to do it. You know, and I did it, and I learned. And there's probably things I'm doing right now that I know full and well I shouldn't be doing, but I do them anyway, and it's human nature, and until people can step up and reason their way to why they need to take care of themselves, then there's always going to be those who feel they have a higher claim to what you do than you do yourself. And I'm going to design something for you to like, and if you don't like it, you don't have a choice. So then you fight and you rebel, and then you get your people, and then it's a circle. I want to go in the right direction, but I don't know how. I think the right direction is not knowing how and not going. You know, if I expect to be anything in concert with what the message of the Tao is trying to put across, it's let go. You stop. and you know, you could sit here and talk about how these people don't like these, but I mean, we're talking about funding rebels here and funding and helping rebels there, and we did that how long ago, and what did those same people do? And it's, we can't learn. We refuse to learn. And that's kind of important. I mean, it's party irrelevant. You know, politics irrelevant. It's the whole nature of the beast right now that we're fighting. And it's, you know, the current is going that way. And we're going to fund those rebels because that's just the nature of our politics today, you know. I mean, I could get into to things like the money, but, I mean, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that those who can fund certain things get what they want, and they want to build weapons, and it's a big circle, and I'm just trying to fight the current to get myself to where I think the best position is for when we go around the bend, because I don't know, nobody knows what's around the bend, you know. Probably rambled a little bit, I'm sorry.
Great talk, Stephen. Wow, makes me think of so many things. But I just had a specific question because you mentioned it, and it just always amazes me when you find out something the military can do because they have the power and they don't have to ask permission. Were there rounds that contained uranium?
Oh, we have those.
Okay,
we
totally
use those. They're armor piercing, and you know, I think it's a, yeah, it's not, it, yeah.
Not very radioactive,
yeah,
but enough maybe to result in some birth defects.
You have no idea. You have no idea, and it's not just us. It's we had uncovered the Iraqi that I was, the Iraqi colonel. He had uncovered 12 to 15 big rounds full of some poor guy's poor attempt at making mustard gas, and I'm not saying that it's just us. It's just it's a variable of what conflict entails, and maybe I painted a false picture of that. You know, we're the only ones over there causing these things, and it's not, because you know the bad guys are trying to come up with the next best thing too, and you just don't know.
Yeah, I think war is hell. I mean, ironically, I'm working with mustard gas in my laboratory right now.
Yeah,
and another gaseous insecticide I'm working with, I have to report to the Department of Homeland Security because it is a little pill that reacts with moisture in the air, and so it could easily be used for terrorism.
Wow.
I have a student from Iran who I wanted to have co-advised by somebody, a scientist at the federal government, and she was told she couldn't. I haven't even tried to get her in the building, Dick. What do you think? Yeah. No, so none of those scientists can serve on her committee. Anyway, I'm just rambling, but
no,
thank
okay.
you for bringing all these things to our attention.
I'll be quick. We're running out of time. Interesting juxtaposition between you and Ken and your experiences. I realize Vietnam was a different culture, different history, different peoples, totally. Even a different century. But do you think we learned anything in Vietnam that applied to Iraq and that we might apply to our next intervention wherever and whenever it might occur?
I hope so. I don't think Iraq has been... We still don't even know the end result of us leaving yet, so it's hard to write the history just yet. I mean, we're in such a hurry to write the history of things that happened yesterday, and we don't even know the third, fourth, and 20th order effects of what they're going to cause. We're just very impatient people. So with that, thank you so much.
Really great, a very nice, insightful, clear, reasoned approach, and I know that there's no one answer for everybody, but thank you for sharing with us. And what I learned in Vietnam that I don't think we learned after I was there about 6 months was that war is a old-fashioned, archaic form of conflict resolution, but I can't convince a lot of other people. In any case, for our closing number, 293, O Star of Truth, Dick and Pat, if you would lead this, please. Thank you, and Tom Biet, and let's have some coffee, huh?